Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance and Policy Committee. Today is March 21st, and the first order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Present.
Backer.
Backer here.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Bierman, present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, present.
Heal.
Present.
Heal, present. Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor. Pryor. Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. And then, Representative Quam, would you care to move the minutes of March 18th?
I would so move, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So the minutes of March 18th are before us for approval. They were mailed out to everyone. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 18th, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So we have a pretty full agenda for today, members, as we will for the rest of the week, since we're approaching the first bill deadline. And Representative Richardson is here with us today with House File 2586. And since she's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 2586 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And then, Representative Richardson, you have an author's amendment, the DE2. Would you like to have that moved to put the bill in the right shape, and then you'll explain it as amended?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. So the chair will move the DE2 author's amendment. All in favor of adoption of the DE2 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the DE2 is amended. So, Representative Richardson, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2586, as amended, establishes the Emmett Lewis Till Victims Recovery Program. And the Department of Health, with a one-time appropriation of $500,000 in fiscal year 23, with the funding available through fiscal year 24. The bill would require the Commissioner of Health to develop a culturally informed grant program in consultation with community-based organizations and with family members of victims that have been impacted by and experienced trauma resulting from government-sponsored activities that have devastated those families. It would also require a report to come back to the legislature. The bill would require a range of health and wellness supports, remembrance and legacy preservation, activities focused on healing for families that are suffering. The research is clear that unresolved trauma will impact your future health. When trauma goes untreated, it festers and increases risks for mental health diagnoses, physical risks such as high blood pressure, stroke, or heart attack, self-harm, suicidal thoughts, and actions, just to name a few. This bill is focused on ensuring there's access to supports and healing for families that are suffering. Madam Chair, I want to yield the majority of my time today to the testifiers who are here with us to not only share their families' painful stories, but what this bill would mean to them.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Richardson. So the first testifier is actually, I think, is on video. And although in a way we're all on video, but anyway, Resma Menachem. So we will go to that video. And we're not hearing it.
Madam Chair, when they go to play the video, they may have to select while they're sharing to share audio at the same time. So they may need to stop sharing, share audio, and then retry.
Okay. We'll just give Mr. McQuillan a moment to try to do that if he can't.
Hello, my name is Resma Menakem. I'm a clinical social worker. I have been working in the area of violence and specifically racialized violence for the past 30 years. I want to support the Emmett Till Victims Recovery Act, primarily because of the work that I've done over the years. I've noticed a need, a void that has a need to be filled. And that need is that many times people who have dealt with racialized trauma or violence, one of the things that happens is that we don't understand the historical impact, the intergenerational impact, the persistent institutional impacts, and then the personal impacts of that violence and that terror and that horror. So I believe that this act could actually serve as a foundation for addressing violence across generations as opposed to just in the moment. As we all know, people who suffer from and deal with domestic violence need very long-term care. And in this case of racialized violence, and specifically police violence and community violence, one of the things that happens is that we've had a tendency in this society and in this structure, and in Minnesota in particular, we've had a tendency to only give resources for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and not really contend with the long-term major impacts of this type of violence and how it has damaged both community and individuals. So I'm in 100% in support of the Emmett Till Victims Recovery Act. Thank you for your time and keep the work going.
All right, thank you. So the next person is Deborah Watts. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. My name is Deborah Watts. I'm the co-founder of the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation and also a cousin of Emmett Lewis Till, who at 14 years of age was brutally murdered in 1955. That's nearly 67 years ago, just down the river, south of here in Mississippi. He traveled from Chicago, just east of here, to visit relatives in Mississippi. Visiting a store in Money, Mississippi, he whistled at 21-year-old store owner Carolyn Bryant Donham. And on August 28, 1955, later her husband and half-brother J.W. Milam kidnapped Emmett and ventured on a 30-mile torturous journey that we now call the Till Trail of Tears and Terror. Emmett was beaten, lynched, and shot in the head with a 75-pound cotton gin fan tied around his neck with barbed wire, and he was thrown into the Black Bayou and later emerged from the Tallahatchie River. Mamie Till Mobley, through her unspeakable pain, trauma, and grief, and courage, she decided to allow her son's monster-like appearance to be viewed during his funeral with an open casket, seen by thousands to share in bearing witness to the ugliness of racialized terror and violence. Yes, a lynching. Her only precious son, Emmett, or Bobo, as she affectionately called him. This type of violence occurred after the slave ships landed 1619 on the shores of the colony of Virginia. And according to a recent statement by Congressman Bobby Rush, chief sponsor of the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, there were 6,500 lynchings that occurred from 1870 through 1950. And that's also according to the Equal Justice Initiative and the Lynching in America documents. So historically, that's the perspective that I present. But most importantly, we all need to know that lynching reinforced a narrative of racial difference and the legacy of racial inequality that is apparent in our criminal justice system today. mass incarceration, racialized bias, capital punishment, excessive sentencing, disproportionate sentencing of racial minorities, and police abuse of people of color. It reveals the problems in America's society that were shaped by that terror era. Well, Mamie, like many others today, thought about ending it all. But for her, the thought of the child possibly finding her body and her not having the fashioned forward pants on, that choice for her was unthinkable. So she lived with the pain and fighting for justice for 47 years without the benefit of support to maintain a healthy way to recover, which took a toll on her mental and physical state. Well, without the adequate support or resources, she only had the pity and the sympathy of the world to sustain her, the heirs, her relatives, and generations like myself who are left to carry on. Community-based organizations like the Communities United Against Police Brutality and CARE Minnesota have recorded that over 400 names of known victims of police brutality and violence in America have occurred. We certainly are not attempting to right all the wrongs of the past, but this is an important step that we in Minnesota can lead the nation by helping the families of victims recover from the loss of their loved ones that's occurred as a result of government-sponsored activities. And so I hope that we will get the support for the Emmett Lewis Till Victims Recovery Program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Watts. Next, we have Amity Dymock, if I'm saying that right. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, and all committee members. It is Dymock. My name is Amity Dymock. I am the mother of Kobe Dymock Heisler. Kobe Heisler was a 21-year-old beautiful boy who was on the autism spectrum. On August 31st of 2019, he had a bad day that day, and his grandfather called called the 911 in fear of my son hurting himself. They de-escalated the situation quickly. The grandfather called 911 back. Regardless, 911 came anyhow. Brooklyn Center police shot and murdered my son 6 times in his own home in front of his grandmother. I am here to support the bill because 4 days before this happened, I said at a board meeting that this was my greatest fear. Could you ever believe that I would actually get the call 4 days later that my son had been murdered by the police? I think that I always change what I'm going to say. And one thing that, and the reason I do is because Resma has been doing this for 30 years. Deborah, 67 plus. It's really important that us as family members have the support to continue to push forward, because at this point, everything that was important to me was taken. And what I have left is to try to change the policies and bills and laws to make it so this never happens to another family member again, that nobody in our community ever has to experience what we're experiencing. And one last thing that I'd like to say is that a trauma like this, some people say that time helps heal wounds. I would proffer that it only gets harder as the time goes on. So please support this bill. Whatever you can do, we are citizens of this country, and we need help from you in this. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate Deborah Watts and the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation for understanding how great this need is. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dymock. We appreciate you sharing with us, and obviously it's so painful for you to do, and we really do appreciate it. Karen Wells? Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Please introduce yourself and just go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Karen Wells. I'm the mother of Amir Locke. My son was 22 years old and was murdered by the Minneapolis Police Department on February 2nd, 2022, during a no-knock warrant at the place where he was visiting and sleeping on the couch. He was not listed or wanted on the search warrant that was for property. Since this tragedy, it has taken me to a place mentally that I don't understand. I feel guilty for laughing, smiling, eating a meal, or just going on with my normal activities in life. This is something that has taken a toll on our communities and myself. As his mother, I don't know how to even begin to heal. I believe this bill can help myself and other mothers and families that have lost their loved ones to brutal murders. I don't even know who to turn to and help me with this long road of grieving that will last for the rest of my life. So I believe, like Amity said, it is very important for our community for a bill like this to be passed, for mothers like us who never even imagined that we would wake up one day and realize that our young sons will be taken by a community of protect and serve. So I believe that, like she said, it's very important for a bill like this to be passed for us as the mothers and the community so that we can begin to heal. Because like she said, people say time heals all wounds, but when it comes to your child, I don't think you'll ever be able to be healed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wells. We appreciate sharing with us today. And then finally on my list, I have Linda K. Tyler. Ms. Tyler, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Linda K. Tyler, and I am Amir's auntie. On the day that he was murdered, the next couple days later, my niece looked at me and said, Auntie, what do you do with this anger? I don't know where to put it and how to fuel it. And in my mind, I would consider myself pretty strong, but dealing with this has really broken us down as a family and individually. All I could think about is the piercing screams that rang out as we watched the release of the body cam, because we were all gathered in a community room and we were trying to support each other. And it plays over and over in my mind. When I close my eyes, I see my nephew trying to wake from his sleep and being kicked, the couch being kicked. I see people surrounding him and I keep thinking about his fear and what he must have went through. I try not to think about it because it's too painful. Our family is experiencing what I would term as complex trauma because it's something that you continually go through day after day, whether it's a news report that you read about and you see the video cam, or whether as we're doing this, bills start to pass. So you never, ever get a chance to go through the grieving process where somebody passes, you bury them, you start to grieve, and there's various stages that you go through. Where with this, it's hard to go through those stages. I have a 9-year-old child, and it was difficult for me when she looked at me and said, Mommy, why did the police kill my cousin? For one, I can't answer the question. I don't know how. And now I have to work with my daughter to help her to not fear cops. Because when she sees them, she always say, we have to be careful. And that should not be the legacy or the journey of a child. So when I heard about this bill, I thought it was extremely important because the mental anguish that families are going through at the hands of public officials or at the hands of the police, it really is troubling. And we have to do something about it. We can't sit back and think that it's okay. Because even after the papers are already written, even after the story has done, what you see is the residual effects, which is these families and the continuous trauma that we are dealing with. So I strongly believe that this act would give families like mine the ability to be able to navigate these uncharted waters that we didn't ask to be a part of. We never saw it. And it would also give us the resource and tools that we would need to deal with this. Thank you.
Why don't you email
Thank
him?
You. Representative Backer? Okay, good. Sorry, Ms. Taylor. Tyler, I'm sorry. Anyway, thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, that comes to the end of our scheduled testifiers. Is there any discussion questions or discussion from members? All right, I'm not seeing any. Oh, yes, I do see some now. Okay, Representative Ryer and then Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing forward this powerful and important legislation. I really have no words right now because all I have are feelings for the families. And so the main thing I want to do is thank Ms. Watts, Ms. Dimmock, Ms. Wells, and Ms. Tyler for using your terrible experience that no one should have to go through to help others. And I just am grateful to you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to the testifiers who came forward and are willing to share their stories. I just want to say up front that my questions are in no way meant to communicate any insensitivity to each of you who have experienced this severe trauma and are grieving. These questions are really only meant to clarify some of the details of this bill. So to Representative Richardson, I have a question about the question is, would an individual need to show evidence? Some of the language in here was talking about the equal protection violations. So my question is, would an individual need to show evidence of equal protection violations to be served by this program?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ackland, looking at the DE2 amendment, there were actually changes that were made to the and it refers to government-sponsored activities.
Representative Ackland?
I'm sorry. So, but government-sponsored activities, I understand that, but do they need to show evidence of
Representative Richardson?
Madam Chair, Representative Ackland, with the changes through the DE2 amendment, the language that you're referring to was removed within the DE2. And so what would need to be demonstrated in order to get access to these services, just to be clear, we're talking about supporting not only family members, but community members that have been impacted by government-sponsored activities. So there's no equal protection violation language within the DE2.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And do we have an
idea?
Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. Do we have an idea of how many Minnesotans will be served by this program?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ackland, at this time, we do not have a number. I will say that the reality is it's too many. Because this shouldn't be a situation that any family finds themselves in. But the goal of this funding is to be able to invest dollars to support communities and families that have been impacted by this and to come back with a report from the department to be able to demonstrate outcomes. And our goal would be that with the right outcomes that we would be able to continue to provide this level of support that's much needed within the community, as has been evidenced by this testimony today.
Yeah, Representative Ackland, anything further?
Yes, thank you for your answer. And again, my sympathy to those who have testified, and just want to confirm that grief is not something that necessarily fades with time. And I can appreciate that even in less trying circumstances. I've seen that that is true. So blessings to all of you who testified. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ackland. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so much gratitude to the people that had the strength to come forward today and talk about this particular bill and what we're trying to accomplish here, but also about why what's happened and the tragedy and injustice that you're trying to address. And I just wanted to make one comment is that I'm grateful to see Deborah Watts, Ms. Watts here today. We've crossed paths a couple times over the years, and I know that you're someone that I really admire and respect, and that you've brought a lot to me personally in my understanding and helping me in understanding. And I just want to say also that even in this brief hearing where we only touch on these stories and what the trauma is, you know, I learned a lot even now, and this idea of complex trauma resonates. And I think that we're building a good foundation for doing the right things moving forward. And so thank you, Representative Richardson, for your strength and your persistence. And thank you all for testifying today. We truly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And so just before I go to Representative Richardson for the final word, I just would like to also thank the testifiers. And it isn't just grief, it's trauma. And everybody experiences grief, but not everybody has this kind of trauma. And as in this committee, we've started to learn, and I think the legislature has just started to learn of the kinds of long-term serious impacts that trauma can have. And so Representative Richardson mentioned in the community, it's not only the people who are, you know, God help us, the mother of a person who had this kind of a terrible death, but also a whole community is traumatized when these kinds of things happen. So it is really insidious. And thank you very much, Representative Richardson, for bringing the bill. And I'd like to give you the final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a saying that the body keeps the score. And the impacts of unresolved trauma can be deadly. And I just want to extend my thanks to Ms. Dimmick, Ms. Wells, Ms. Watts, and Ms. Tyler for their testimony today. There are absolutely no words to express the loss of a child or a loved one in these circumstances. And I also just want to lift up the fact that for each of them, this is not the first time that they're having to share their story. And the pain and trauma that's associated with a retelling of something so devastating over and over again is something that we as a legislature should want to avoid. So it's my hope that there can be bipartisan support for these efforts, so we can move beyond reliving the trauma of this and really start to move through the stages of trauma recovery. And we are only going to get there if there is access to these types of supports in the community that are being offered in a culturally informed way. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Richardson. So with that, House File 2586, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you again, everyone. We will now go to House File 4001, Representative Hewitt. Would you like to move 4001 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill?
Madam Chair, I would.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Hewitt, if you would please present the bill.
I have to find my place. Here we are, 4001. they want to present the other bill yet. So this is a very simple technical bill. It is a departmental bill. They are here to answer questions on it. The department's been having trouble when they have these large conventions come to town for body art. And we would like to get as many people as possible, the artists qualified under Minnesota law for licensing. However, they request them within a 24-hour period of when the convention starts. So this basically puts into some better lanes so the department can actually get their licensing to them before the event starts, at least 14 days out, Madam Chair. Unless there's any other questions for the department, I would like to move the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions or discussion to the bill? All right, seeing none, thank you, Representative Hewitt. So House File 4001 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. You might have the record for the quickest bill this year. Okay, next is House File 3874, Representative Ryer. And the motion there is that House File 3874 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill, and that would be Representative Ryer's motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
All right. And with that, Representative Ryer, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm bringing forward House File 3874. It's a Minnesota Department of Health policy bill pertaining to dental cone beam imaging. In the interest of time, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Lisa Timian from the MDH to explain it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Ms. Timian, are you here? There she is. Welcome. Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Lisa Timian, and I'm the Legislative Director here at the Department of Health. I do think I have a colleague, actually, who I'm hoping is going to jump in right now because they can speak to this, but... Sorry, this is
okay. That's all right. Is there someone here from MDH who can speak to this bill?
Madam Chair, this is Stefan Gildemeister. I'm happy to be of assistance.
Okay, Mr. Gildemeister, you have many talents. I did not know imaging facilities were among them, but please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think it'll become clear where my talents do not lie. So quickly, for the record, Stefan Gildemeister, direct the Health Economics Program. And in the role of collecting data to conduct analysis is why I've come before you today. So essentially, Representative Ryer's bill is looking to exempt dental offices from the collection of diagnostic imaging facility data. The reason for this really is that as the bill was passed originally in 2004, it was intended to collect data on CT, MRI, and PET utilization and financial data from diagnostic imaging facilities. Since then, under certain circumstances, some dentists use dental cone beam CT for activities related to orthodontics. And they are subject then to reporting. It's a fairly significant reporting burden on them for a very small volume of data and services. We tend to focus really on the diagnostic imaging facilities that deliver this as primary service to primary business. And so the dentists are kind of pulled in by the fact that they sometimes conduct cone beam CT imaging. So we have about 3% of all CT scans coming in as dental cone CTs, and it's a very small part of the total. It accounts for a significant burden on the dentist, so we recommended to exempt dental offices from this reporting burden. In the scope of things, it's a very small share in terms of cost and services.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Are there any questions from members or discussion to the bill? Sounds like something we can all get behind. Reducing regulation, reducing reporting for somebody. That sounds like a good deal.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Gildemeister.
If I, thank you, Madam Chair. If I may add one more element, the machines, which of course deliver ionized radiation to a patient, are still regulated by the Environmental Health Division of the department. So that oversight remains in place. It's just that additional submission of data that is covered by this language.
All right. Thank you for that explanation. So questions or discussion? I'm not seeing any. So Representative Ryer, anything you want to say further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I went to the dentist this morning. My dentist likes this bill. And I'm glad to see it later.
All right. Thank you very much. So with that, House File 3874 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. So thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Okay, next we have House File 4214, Representative Bolden. And Representative Bolden's motion would be that House File, well, let's see, I've got two different numbers here, transposed. Okay, House File 4214 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. And Representative Bolden, I hope I have the right number. Is that it?
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair.
Good deal. So go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I bring another opportunity to decrease reporting. So this is a bill brought by MDH. This is a proposal for a technical change to a reporting requirement for ST segment elevation myocardial infarction, or STEMIs, which for those of you unfamiliar with that terminology is a type of heart attack, which requires some reporting in current statute. So since implementation, hospitals in Minnesota with STEMI programs have maintained low participation in national registries, which collect and provide the necessary data. As of last year, only 4 out of the 16 Minnesota STEMI programs are known to contribute to an appropriate registry, and only 2 of those have granted permission for MDH to access their patient-level registry data. So because of this, MDH is not able to produce a report that is meaningful and representative of the quality of STEMI care in our state. And thus, they are asking for the reporting requirement to be rescinded. And if there are questions, I believe Ms. Timian is on to take those as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bolden. So any discussion? We don't have anyone scheduled to actually testify on this. I think Representative Bolden did a good job explaining it. Are there questions or any discussion? Okay, not seeing any. So with that, then, House File 4214 will be laid over for possible, or is laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. Thank you, Representative Bolden. Next, we have House File 4213, which is Representative Wolgamott. And Representative Wolgamott's motion is that House File 4213 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. And Representative Wolgamott, did you want to move your DE1 right now?
So moved, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. So Representative Wolgamott is moving the DE1 author's amendment. Do we need to discuss that before we vote on it, Representative Wolgamott?
No, this is just to get the bill in the shape that I would like it to be in. So I could just walk you through all of it now or do it after we move the amendment.
Yeah,
your
thank
preference,
you.
Madam Chair.
Let's adopt the amendment and then we'll... Representative Backer, unmuted. Okay, the perils of virtual meetings. Okay, so the DE1 author's amendment is before us. All in favor of adopting the DE1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any
aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
All right, the motion prevails and the DE1 author's amendment is adopted. So Representative Wolgamott, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. I am here to present House File 4213 as amended, which is a piece of legislation that I've been working on with the department. Really, the reason why we're bringing this bill forward, Madam Chair and members, is because the MDH Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program currently requires that a provider's place of business be located in a federally designated health professions shortage area or medically underserved area. What this proposal does, Madam Chair, is add an alternative criterion that would allow providers to become eligible if they serve a significant percentage of people who meet low-income guidelines or are uninsured or are underinsured. There are several clinics around the state that do not technically fall within the border of a designated medically underserved area, but their entire client base is drawn from an underserved population. So by making this change in general law, we'll make sure that applicants from these clinics will be eligible for this program. So that's the problem that we're hoping to solve with this bill, Madam Chair and members. And with that, I have testifiers from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, as well as the department to provide their testimony and answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Wolgamott. I don't have anybody listed on my sheet, but if there are people here who want to testify to the bill, not just answer questions, let me know. And no, okay. Possibly not. And so let's just go to member discussion, questions or discussion, and knowing that we do have folks here who can answer questions. Ms. Radosovic, did you want to speak to the bill first, or do you want to just answer questions?
Madam Chair, I'm available to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. So members, any questions or comments? All right, not seeing any. I just would comment that, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. You know, I had this very same situation in my district. And just because you're not in a shortage area does not mean that your mission isn't, and your whole focus, in fact, isn't serving these very same patients. So I appreciate the effort to make this change. And because our focus should be on making sure that we have services for those who need them, not necessarily just because you happen to be in this area or that area. With that, I'm not seeing any other discussion or questions. Representative Wolgamott, any closing comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the department for working on this legislation. And I'll ask for members' consideration further down the road. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So House File 4213, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health bill. Okay, House File 3691, Representative Hewitt. And Representative Hewitt's motion is that House File 3691 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Hewitt, did you want to right now move the DE1 author's amendment?
Madam Chair, I do.
Okay, so let's adopt the DE1, and then Representative Hewitt can explain that to us as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the DE1 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The DE1 is adopted. Representative Hewitt, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the amendment basically got the bill in the order that we needed. And first of all, I would really like to thank Representative Keel and Representative Backer on a real tough situation here. As all of us know, we just went through the audit with this service in our state. And we were not happy, somewhat embarrassed in some cases. And that's kind of what this bill does, is do a bandage for now. We have a lot of work to do together to make it right, but this is a bandage to move us in the right direction to make sure we are not in any way hampering delivery of ambulance service around the state. This bill basically helps us in a number of areas. The transportation costs that we experience with any EMT, this is our wheelchair services, they have been having a real hardship here with their fuel pricing. This actually is really interesting, the way this was done. It actually puts an escalator on it based on the fuel pricing. It can go up or down, but this basically would give them a big boost. Again, we're not quite where we need to be with these services, but we're getting closer. Same thing applies towards our ambulance services. All our ambulance services, their vehicles pretty much operate on diesel. If you went by a diesel pump lately, you know what the price is. And this will also give them that much needed help. As far as the actual policy in the bill, It will address different situations that they asked for in waivers, but because of the current situation with the MSRB, none of us felt very comfortable in giving them the waivers, but we gave services the permission to do some of the following. Part of it is ambulance staffing. You may hear from Representative Backer later on that the staffing problem continues in outstate. What they need is the ability to use like firefighters or police officers. Right now they can't do that. This bill will allow them to just go ahead and use them. They will have to have some reporting requirements. And basically if they do that outside of the realm, they're gonna have to do a report to the EMSRB, which in turn would do a report to us. It also lets them use people that have expired licensing. They have to work towards getting their license, but yet we don't have to pull them off the trucks if they are currently expired. The more controversial part of the bill basically is the use of expired medications. This has actually been going on for a while. I worked with the Board of Pharmacy on this to make sure they were okay with this. They now have to be brought into the consultation of the local medical director and the local service provider to discuss what drugs they're actually going to use and if they can be used. So, and again, if they do this, a report has to be issued to the MSRB, then we'll issue us a report. And the other part of the report that is, again, an embarrassing part of the bill, but we have to do it. There was some mistakes financially at the MSRB that we found. Part of that is they went in, they went into an agreement that the board didn't even know about with a lease that they could not afford. They have made the move. They need some money to pay that lease, and they also are down one staff person. So I'm asking for $200,000 to help them get through this. I'll have to put that and absorb that into their budget later on. At that, Madam Chair, I have two testifiers here today, Mr. McAlpin from the industry and also a ambulance director, Mrs. Angie. I'm sorry, I don't have her last name in front of me, but I think they can kind of tell you what the current status of this and the support that this will, that who supports this bill. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Hewitt. So let me then go to Mr. McAlpin. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I think Representative Hewitt did a nice job walking through it. We worked with these similar waivers over the past year or so, and even a little longer under the governor's emergency powers when we had it. So many of these waivers were used by the industry. As we came to the tail end here, what we hope is getting to the end of COVID. Our workforce was in tough shape before COVID, especially in rural Minnesota. We have no idea why our board tracks about 60% of EMTs certified today are not working on ambulance. That's an alarming number. So as Representative Hewitt talked about with what happened with the OLA audit, we also think this is another great path to assure that the folks out on the street and our volunteers and even some of our paid ambulance services can use some different staffing models to be sure you all continue and your neighbors and friends access ambulance services. The issue on the expired drugs comes up with people about using expired drugs and the fear with that. Some other state agencies across the country with EMS, the pharmacy board has just put a list out, but we are having quite a problem with supplies and getting stuff delivered to us still. So let's just say an airway that's package expires today. We wouldn't want to take it off the ambulance and not have that equipment at all available. So with our medical directors and working with the pharmacy board, we think that's a great option. And we do think that this is a way that we can continue to keep ambulances staffed. The fuel escalators, we have been working with Representative Keel. I'd like to ask you for hundreds of millions of dollars for non-emergency. It is an industry that is quite scarred. When that industry is not viable, the ambulance industry picks up that load, and the fuel escalators is a good start in this conversation. Their number is $3 a gallon. When it goes over $3, they have to stop transporting patients. So many of them are at that point now. So we appreciate your support, Madam Chair members.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. And then Angie Jarrett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My video is on, but it's not
showing up, so I apologize for that. But my name is Angie Jarrett, and I am an ambulance director in Dodge Center, Minnesota, to which we are a countywide ambulance in southeastern Minnesota that serves the communities of Dodge Center, Casson, Manorville, Claremont, and then the surrounding townships. We respond to approximately 1,100 emergency calls for service annually and serve a population of about 15,000 people. Our staff is comprised of a mix of both paid staff and paid on-call volunteers. The proposed bill is definitely a pragmatic approach to providing ambulance services with the ability to operate, especially during these unprecedented times where we're still experiencing these supply chain shortages, staffing shortages, and low reimbursement rates. By adjusting these personnel response requirements, it will allow services like ours to deploy an ambulance when requested. We always think that there's always going to be an ambulance available, but the alternative to this could mean that there is no ambulance to respond to an emergency. The supply chain shortages have likewise left us without. By allowing these medications and supplies to go past the recommended shelf life, it'll continue to allow us to provide emergency treatments in the field when they're needed. And likewise, the alternate to this would be that there would be no treatment or intervention. The mileage reimbursement rates, those will aid in offsetting our rising costs for operating an ambulance, and then especially already strained systems. So I ask that you think of us as the ambulance services, the people with the boots on the ground that are responding to the emergencies when considering this. I'm here today because I want to give a voice to every ambulance service in Minnesota. I speak for us all when I say that we need your help and that we need your support by adopting these changes. So I sincerely appreciate your time today and allowing me to speak. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Jarrett, for being here today. And also, I think Dr. Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy is here for questions, if there are questions for him about the expired drug issue. So members, questions or discussion? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate working with Representative John Hewitt and Jeff Backer on the NEMT portion also. Certainly the ambulances are important, but by helping our non-emergency transportation, we're able to relieve our ambulance services so that they are not being used for unnecessary transport that can be done by someone else. And I know all over the state, not just in rural Minnesota, we are really struggling with the costs, the insurance increases, the fuel certainly that has risen. Creates problems, and these are businesses that go in vast areas of Minnesota. I have seen transportation on the way down to the cities that I know has left from anywhere from Roseau in those areas to transport somebody to the cities that you couldn't otherwise transport. And I've had the privilege of actually riding in one of these because I could not transport my own aunt, and so we had to go see a specialist in Fargo, and I had that ability to take her, go with her, and be there so that we could see the doctor, but I couldn't have transported her any other way. So these are really important services, and I want to stress that to the members that we need more than this, as Mr. McAlpin said, but this is at least a start, because I'm fearful we're going to lose these services. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to state that I am very thankful to Representative Hewitt for bringing this bill forward. A lot of my district communities are small communities, and I know they're struggling. I've been in contact with them as far as the EMT and the ambulance. I know this is a Band-Aid, but at least it's a step in the right direction. And appreciate any help that you are offering. So thanks again, and thank you to Representative Keel and Backer for working on this with their background.
All right. Thanks, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair. And I know Chair and I have had some really good conversations. Everybody knows my background as an EMS. This is a start. There is a lot of work to do. That's why several of us has been working on it. I've been a hard worker on it. I have other bills that hopefully, you know, as we move forward and we dive into the report that we've into, that we really need. It's so important for rural Minnesota right now. We are at a crossroads. There are less and less of folks of me who will invest 300 to 400 hours a month to volunteer as an EMT. Last night I got laid into St. Paul because we had two runs that I covered last night that were late. So slept 45 minutes past because we had two ambulance runs back to back. And for a small service, that's a lot, you know. So I like what's going. I'm going to continue to work with the author. Him and I have a very good working relationship. We'll work with the Senate, and I just appreciate us continuing to keep those rigs moving out of the garage when someone dials 911. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Backer. And so I would just say, members, that you know, we do have that report from the legislative office, the legislative auditor, and we all got hard copies of it, and there is a lot of work we have to do. And I have to say, I think we're going to be doing major reform, but probably not this year. We're kind of out of time for this year. And every Minnesotan, in my estimation, when they call 911 and they need an ambulance, we need to make sure there is an ambulance there for them. And this is an industry where there's a lot of change needed. But we just have to make sure that in the meantime, that we don't leave Minnesotans without essential service, no matter where they live in the state. Frankly, this isn't only about rural. It's everywhere. And so with our workforce shortages, I think these are reasonable changes to make. I hope we'll be able to do the funding piece. We're waiting on the fiscal note on that. But with that, Representative Hewitt, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot for your support. You have been really a good mentor during this this time, because you've probably been through a few of these. So I want to thank you personally for that. And the testifiers today, Ms. Jarrett, you're having a heck of a year. Thank you for everything you're doing in your company. This is really a tough time, and we're gonna really try to help here. And thank you, Mr. McAlpin, for your hard work on this too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, House File 3691, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. Next bill we're going to move to is House File 3363. That's my bill. And so I'm going to move that House File 3363 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. And so what 3363 does, members, is we're now talking about our medical assistance and our Minnesota Care programs. In this case, I think we're really talking about medical assistance. And under current law, most of the folks who go on medical assistance are required to select a managed care organization. What the bill does is allow them, if they so choose, to opt out of managed care and go on the fee-for-service program. This bill was brought to me by a group of advocates, and I know there are a number of testifiers here, and I'm going to let them speak to the bill, and then hopefully we'll have a little bit of discussion on this concept. So the first person that I have on my list is Rick Rayburn. Mr. Rayburn,
yes,
welcome. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
All right, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rick Rayburn. I'm from Finlayson, Minnesota. I am here in support of HF 3363. I'd like you to consider this. On the MnSure application, every Medicaid applicant must attest to the following: that I understand the state may claim repayment for the cost of medical care or premiums paid for care from my estate. This sounds like a loan.
Mr.
The application
Rayburn
says this.
Mr. Rayburn,
the government...
excuse
yes,
me.
Ma'am.
I don't think you're speaking to the bill that's before us, which is 3363. It's about opting out of a managed care organization. Is that what you're here to speak to?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, you're speaking to a completely different topic, and so I'll let you go on a little bit longer, but we're not here to speak to a topic that's off the bill, so please speak to the bill if you can.
I was. Okay, so why should somebody choose fee-for-service over managed care? I'll give you an example. A couple that uses fee-for-service and are both healthy, that may have annual checkups, they may have a total amount of $800 that could be recovered from their estates. If the same couple is enrolled in managed care, they will have $800 per month per person. Now they have a potential liability to their estate of $19,000 for the same year. If they can opt out of managed care and go on fee-for-service, their estate liability drops to just services used. So with the fee-for-service option in HF 3363, the citizen can only be held responsible through recovery for services rendered. If there are no services used, there is no debt generated. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rayburn, for tying that up for me. I now understand where you're going and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I have Idle Abdul. And welcome, Ms. Abdul.
Hi, there I am. I'm sorry, I'm never tech savvy here. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity. My name is Idle Abdul. I am a Somali mom, Somali autism mom and advocate, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. As you all know, managed care organizations are health insurance companies that contract with the state Medicaid agency to provide health care to low-income people in Minnesota, including children with autism and their families. The idea was to have cost-effective care that is driven by quality and compassion. Sadly, that is not always been the case, particularly in the area of autism. DHS's medical director testified recently in this committee and gave you the data that suggested majority of low-income Minnesotans have MCOs. This is true for autism families. Children with autism who have MCOs, for instance, are not getting the services they need and qualify because the process is different, difficult for providers. Let's say, for example, you have two children with autism. Both of them 5 years old, both of them have the same diagnosis, and they have one, they go to the same provider, and one has fee-for-service and one has MCO. The provider will take the fee-for-service because DHS is managed by fee-for-service, so they'll train the provider on how to submit the claims, where to send the authorization. The process is easier. The provider will know the reimbursement rate. They'll know when they're going to be paid. They know that it's only 2 weeks. On the other hand, the process for MCO, it's confusing. There's no training. You don't know if you're ever going to be reimbursed. You have no idea where to submit your treatment plan. There is nobody there to help you. And these are private. Now they're private insurance companies who've gotten public funds. And this child is not able to get services because if I'm a provider, why should I take the child with the difficult insurance? I'm going to take fee for service because that the process is much easier. I so appreciate you doing this, Representative Liebling, Chair, Madam Chair Liebling. You've been with us when we made the law equal for autism Medicaid, because Medicaid is Medicaid, and MCO is not doing what they're supposed to do, but you can help that. You can say, you can give people the option to opt out, and DHS can do better when they're writing the contract. They can make sure the process is the same, because we don't want to create any more disparity. Minnesota does not want any more disparity. You can read my testimony there. Families have sued MCOs because of discrimination and have won, autism families. And I really don't want more lawsuits. I would like the policy to change, and I would like the MCOs, if you're not going to do what you're supposed to do, then you need to get out of the kitchen. You need to get out of the kitchen and allow us to have a fee for service. Thank you again, as always. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Abdul. And then Dave Finewax, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Finewax. I'm an attorney. I reside in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I wish to speak in support of House File 3363. Thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this issue forward. This is an extremely important issue, and At the end of the day, it is about consumer choice for those people who receive health care through our Minnesota Medical Assistance Program. This bill does not create anything new. It doesn't cost anything in terms of setting up a new program. 25% of the current MA recipients are in fact on fee-for-service. Oddly enough, they are the most acute, most ill, most needly, most costly patients, but 25% of them are on fee-for-service. And if you go to town hall meetings, they will tell you that they love it. Other people on Minnesota's medical assistance program who are now currently forced into or are forced to choose from a managed care organization or perhaps county-based purchasing don't have the luxury of selecting this. This legislation would give them that option. It doesn't force them into that option. It doesn't get rid of competing vendors or programs. It simply creates an option and an opportunity for consumers to choose. The state of Iowa, our neighbor, recently outsourced their Medicaid program to managed care providers. Their costs escalated by a factor of 4. But more importantly, denial of medical services increased by a factor of 10, and they are now moving in the opposite direction. If a patient is happy with managed care, they are entitled to keep it. And I think the best analogy I can leave you with is one involving Medicare. It would be an odd argument to say that because I have chosen traditional Medicare, that I have slapped Medicare Advantage in the face. Even though Medicare Advantage would argue that they offer me more things, a gym membership, a free trip to the dentist, but I chose what I chose because I believe I act in my own best interest, and I believe I should always have that option. This bill gives everyone that option, and people typically act in their own best interest. I have also taken the liberty of submitting to the committee administrator this morning a report done many years ago by Dr. Stephen Foldis, which never saw the light of day, but you all have it now, that says that we really need to look at what we're buying from our managed care organizations in comparison to fee-for-service, because we're paying the same, but it appears that when you're in managed care, you get less, but you're still paying the same amount of money. As always, thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Finewalks.
Actually, it is doctor, but thank you.
Oh, okay. All right. To the degree that we lawyers are also doctors, maybe.
No, I have a PhD.
Oh, there we go. Okay, very good. So thank you for that. So we also have Dan Andreessen from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, a trade association representing Minnesota's nonprofit health plans, many of which who operate as managed care organizations in the state's Medicaid program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify with our concerns regarding 3363 and the potential for confusion for medical assistance enrollees. Today we've heard of situations with managed care, and our plans are operating as MCOs, always open to hearing from enrollees when issues arise, and encourage them to reach out so a resolution can be found. For a majority of Minnesotans enrolled in medical assistance, managed care is the best way to access care compared to fee-for-service because of the care coordination performed by MCOs. There are several benefits offered by MCOs that are not part of the fee-for-service program. This includes supplemental benefits such as additional dental coverage, wellness benefits, incentives for preventative care, education on health and wellness, and notices when key preventive care is missed. Now, every day, MCOs ensure that people schedule appointments, arrange transportation to their doctor, coordinate medical care, and help enrollees access community-based services. A significant portion of the Medicaid population are seniors and Minnesotans living with disabilities, and care coordination is a key for these populations so that enrollees are not missing out on care or face duplicative care. And examples of care coordination are listed in the fact sheet that was provided in your packets. The trend nationally is to require enrollment into managed care, with some exceptions due to the high quality care scores. However, the option to opt out of managed care is already an option for certain cases of autism. And we're concerned that the language in House File 3363 will create confusion when all enrollees have this option when signing up for medical assistance. If providing an enrollee with the option to opt out, we have questions as to whom will provide the enrollee with the information to ensure they're making the informed decision. Would this be performed by county caseworkers or DHS? We should be cautious about setting up a situation where a decision could result in a Minnesotan receiving worse care because fee-for-service may not be the best option for them. We encourage this proposal to be analyzed further before proceeding this session. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. So, members, I mean, I think this really brings us to the question of what does it mean to have choice in healthcare? And very often when we talk about choice in MA, we're talking about choice of health plans. I would submit to you that most people don't want to have to choose a health plan. Whether in the private market or in public programs, choosing a health insurance plan is not what most people mean by choice. What people want to choose is what doctor to go to. What people want from healthcare is to have healthcare available when they need it without barriers in front of it. And so it's just very interesting to me that Mr. Andreessen is talking about confusion here, because frankly, I think that when people go on medical assistance and suddenly they're being asked to choose among sometimes multiple insurance products, that's where you get confusion. And so personally, I don't really see that it would be any more confusing to anyone to have the choice to have their bills paid as they come in. Anyway, a question or a comment from Representative Grinhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, we've kind of talked about this issue for a long time. This is another perspective on it. My question is, if they opt out of the the HMO or whatever, can they opt to fee for service? Can they opt back in again? Is that once a year or how does that work? I got another question.
Well, Representative Grinhagen, I don't think we really contemplated that. I think in the bill, but my assumption would be that every time there's a re-upping your enrollment, that you would probably have the opportunity. I mean, it would be the same as however often now they can change plans, because there is a time period at which people could go from one MCO to another one if there's more than one where they live. So I think it would be every time they have an option like that, they would then also have the option to go to fee for service. Mr. Feinwachs, that looks like you agreed with my statement there. Mr. Feinwachs?
Yes, Madam Chair, I absolutely agree with your statement. And Representative Grinhagen, they would be able to move back and forth during periods of open enrollment, which I believe are on a yearly basis.
Representative Grinhagen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and the other question would be, at the time of sign-up, how are they going to be given information to properly assess fee-for-service versus with the HMOs? Is there anything in the bill that indicates that, or what's your thought about that?
Representative Grinhagen, I did put something about that in the bill, and my thought was, in the same way that DHS notifies enrollees about what's available to them in terms of MCOs, they would just simply also notify them about the option to go into fee-for-service. And I'm looking at the language here, but I don't know if I can find it quickly, but there is language in the bill to do that. So I do think it's important for people to know what's available to them. But, the next procurement in Hennepin County is going to have 6 different MCOs in Hennepin County, in one county. So talk about confusion. I don't know how much more confusing it could be to say to people, here's an option just to have your bills paid as you incur them, and you can go to any willing provider. I don't see how confusing that would be. So good question, though. Other questions or comments? Not seeing any. Okay. And let's see, I think I just put down my agenda in the wrong place. Okay. So I think with that then, members, and thank you to all of the testifiers. So with that, House File 3363 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. My next bill is House File 3823. And House File 3823, the motion is for it to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So so this is kind of a continuation of what we were just discussing. And I think that most members know that PMAP, or the Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, the program under which the state pays a capitated amount to a managed care organization or a county-based purchasing organization, this way of delivering health care has been a so-called demonstration project for about, I'm guessing around 30 years that the state's been doing this. And as you just heard from Mr. Feinwachs on the previous bill, this is not a universal way to manage a Medicaid program. In fact, the state of Iowa just very recently went to a similar system and saw their costs just absolutely balloon. So we've never had a very clear analysis that I'm aware of the cost of delivering our public program this way, or really of how good this is for patients. Way back when this was started, I believe the argument was that it was hard for Medicaid patients to get an appointment, that a lot of providers wouldn't see a Medicaid patient. And the argument for MCOs was that they had a network and that they could leverage their private network to get coverage and get providers to also see Medicaid patients. But in the ensuing years, I think this has changed a lot. We now have well over a million Minnesotans who are on our public programs. And we are not always getting people seen under the MCOs, as we found out when we worked on dental care in the last session. We found that, in fact, rates for people getting to actually see a dentist are rather low. So this is a system that I believe personally that it's time to replace it. And so what the bill is proposing is to replace the entire managed care program with a program where the state would hire a third-party administrator just to administer the program, not to shift risk as we supposedly right now do under our current program with our managed care organizations, but that the state can very well deal with the so-called insurance risk, and we don't need them to do that for us, and that we would be saving a lot of money and could also find ways to, if care coordination is needed, that there are other ways to do that care coordination. So one of the things I wanted to do, I don't know if Mr. Berg is on, I hope he is. I prepped him because I wanted him to tell us, if he could, how much money we are spending on PMAP. Mr. Berg, I don't know if you were able to get that information for me.
Madam Chair, there we go. Having trouble with my video there. To answer, you were guessing about 30 years on the demonstration project. I was just reading the year 26 annual report, which is for fiscal year 21. So we're currently in the 27th year of it. The total premium cost of all public products for all plans was $7,987,000,000. I mean, just barely below $8 billion. And that, of course, is the PMAP cost. That doesn't rely. I know you also had a question about what's being spent on fee-for-service, which I do not. I've asked the department about that, and they have produced that number previously, but I don't have that portion of it.
All right, Mr. Bergen, is that $8 billion an annual number, or is that a biennial?
That's an annual number. That's for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2021.
Okay, so it's about $16 billion every 2 years for PMAP now.
Yep.
All right, $16 billion. So
again, the premium cost, there's then the you go from there to the actual medical costs and the admin costs and other stuff like that. But that's the top line number.
Right, right. So thank you very much for that. So I'm going to let Mr. Andreessen testify. I know he's wanting to testify against this bill. Of course he is. Because, and you know, members, I just want to flag for you though. What are we talking about here? We're talking about $16 billion state and federal dollars to provide care for over a million Minnesotans. And I am certainly supportive of doing that. And I think we all are. However, as stewards of the public dollar, I think it really is on us to know where that money is going. And I submit to you that under the PMAP program, we do not know where that money is going. We have very little control over these programs and very little knowledge about where the money is really going and what we're really getting for it. So, you know, as stewards of the public dollar, I would like you all to think about this very, very seriously. And Representative Ryer has her hand up. I'm going to let Mr. Andreessen testify, and then we'll do a little more discussion on it, if that's okay, Representative Ryer. So, Mr. Andreessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about our concerns about ending the state's managed care program. In 1985, the state began using managed care as a model as a solution to the wild fluctuations in Medicaid costs and the problems arising from providers unwilling to see Medicaid enrollees. Now, the managed care model provides several significant benefits to the state. First is that managed care provides financial predictability. MCOs accept a predetermined per member per month payment that's locked in for the length of the annual contract with the state. This helps the state with certainty in the budgeting process when budgets are set and the legislature appropriates money for the Medicaid program. Second, by using a managed care model system, MCOs take on the financial risk if enrollee costs exceed state payments. The inverse can also happen when costs are lower than projected. This happened last year when the state reclaimed a portion of the payments made to MCOs due to lower utilization of healthcare because of the COVID pandemic. And the third benefit of this model is access to quality healthcare. In your packet is a report on the quality of managed care programs and its performance on key quality measures. The report states that MCOs outperform fee-for-service models attributed to the fact that MCOs have structured care coordination, as I testified in the previous bill. The managed care program is a partnership between the MCO and the state, and throughout the year, our MCOs meet with DHS to ensure we are following rules set by the state and federal government and meeting the goals established in MCO contracts. MCOs are regularly audited for financial accountability, and these reports, along with the MCO contracts, are publicly posted on DHS and MDH websites. There was a comment made actually on the previous bill on administrative expenses. I want to point out that the state does cap MCO administrative expenses at 6.6%. This is in state statute 256B.69. Besides undoing this successful model, moving towards a single administrator will also reduce enrollee choice. And so one of the issues with choice is that if there is one option, that's the option you have. So right now, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, Medicaid enrollees do have an option when they sign up for a managed care plan, and they're able to select that one based on their individual needs. Now, under a single administrator model, enrollees will have one choice. And if that plan doesn't fit their needs, they won't have another option. And the state has attempted using single administration in the past, which has resulted in worsening health and experience. And a recent example is when the state utilized a single vendor for its preferred incontinence program. Because incontinence products are different for everyone, some enrollees could not access the products they needed, which resulted in bed sores, infections, and unnecessary trips to the hospital. So in this case, any cost savings came at the expense of enrollee choice and health. So we would urge the committee to not go down this path. The state went into a managed care model for good reasons and would advocate not going in this direction. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Andreessen. I can't believe you compared choosing a managed care organization to choosing an incontinence product. That is a new one. Okay. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am thinking about my many years as a researcher in the health industry, doing research with groups as varied as members, providers, employers, so that's not relevant in this conversation. And the concerns I always hear are about how difficult the existing system is, how the system seems to be set up to tell them, no, you can't see this doctor, no, you can't get this service. It is the managed care system, and I was around in the, not quite when it started with group health, but when Blue Cross launched Blue Plus, I was of the era, and I've watched the complexity of the administrative systems and the cost that goes into the administration of it absolutely compound. And so what I would like to think about is when you take, what was it, 6.5% admin rate of $16 billion, a lot of that is going to things that are not value generating. And we could take so much of that to other organizations that would be able to help provide care, because as Chair Liebling noted, we learned pretty well that the arguments that we needed the managed care in dental because care could be coordinated, we found that there was no care happening to be coordinated. So I just think it is time for a good, strong, clear look at it, improve members' experience, improve provider experience, and be good stewards of the state dollars. I guess I don't have a question, Madam Chair, just a statement.
Yeah, thank you very much, Representative Ryer. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered, Madam Chair, if Mr. Berg might have some numbers. He gave us the 7.98 per year figure. But over the course of 27 years, I suppose he could provide numbers for the committee on the rate of increase of the contracts over that span of time, and that might be some good information for us to take a look at.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, I'd have to look into that. I mean, rate of increases, I mean, you have both the growth in enrollment and, I mean, I assume what you mean is the inflation in the costs, not in the enrollment, but...
Correct. Yes.
I'll have to talk to the department about that. I mean, the reports are out there.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Bierman, anything further? Okay. All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Andreessen. Is there any examples in other states that have moved the direction that Representative Liebling's bill moves us, and do you know any results?
Mr. Andreessen, that might be better for the department, but Mr. Andreessen, you can.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there have been some states, I think mainly on the benefit side, where they've carved out some benefits and they've gone back to carve them back in because of either costs or access issues. So I would need to get the actual specific states, but there have been some that have gone in that direction.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Then Representative Liebling, are you aware, or maybe the department, where this has been done and what the results are from it in another state?
I'm not personally aware of that in other states. I don't know if anybody on the call would have that information today. I don't know if Mr. Burdick is here or, yeah. Ms. Marquardt, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie Marquardt, I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for the Healthcare Administration at DHS. And I guess this is just to say we don't either have anything offhand. There's some states who do populations, certain services, but we don't have any information about a state that's recently moved to an opt-out and what their results have been, but we can certainly take a look at that and get back to you.
That Thank you. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is there anything in your bill that would evaluate, if this were to become law, that would evaluate what the results would be in a year or 2 years or whatever time frame would be reasonable?
Representative Grunhagen, I don't think I put anything like that in the bill, but I certainly think it's a good idea. So, you know, thank you. Thank you for that. You know, I also, it does kind of prompt me to say to members, you know, the way I drafted this bill also took out the county-based purchasing in addition to the other MCOs. And I'm not wedded to that. I think we really need to look hard at what value we're getting. But I think there are a lot of different ways we could be thinking about this and working on it. So, you know, if I think this is a discussion that we as members really urgently need to have when we're spending $16 billion a biennium on these services, and most of this is running through private organizations who are each spending a large amount of money on administration. Of course, they have to. That there's also a lot of money being spent, I don't know how much, managing this beast, doing the procurement. And I don't know about you, but I get complaints from providers who don't want to deal with multiple different MCOs. And we get complaints from patients who are subject to these networks and don't want to be subject to them. So I think this is a really important thing to have and be thinking about it. I'm in no way saying that I have the perfect formula here, but I do also want to note for members that right now the department is planning to end the single county-based purchasing. Let me say that better. Right now, county-based purchasing in rural counties is a single plan. They have single plan status, and right now the department is planning to end that and introduce an MCO also into those counties. And this is something that the county-based purchasers are fighting back against, right? So there's a lot of argument, discussion, flux right now about what are we doing in these counties? What should we have there? What is the department is saying they should have choice, enrollees should have choice in these rural counties. I think the counties would probably be saying, among other things, that there aren't that many providers there. Why do you need more plans to contract with the same providers? So, you know, there are just a lot of ways we could think about this as we go forward. We should all have the goal of making sure that we spend our public dollars efficiently, that we use them to buy the best possible care and outcomes for our neighbors and members of our communities who are on these programs. We want these programs to be great programs and deliver good care. It is not our problem to support businesses that are right now providing this. I really feel that we need to be looking at the taxpayer, the enrollee, the outcomes, and let that be our guiding star, and not anybody's business interests. And that can be tough, as you all know. I mean, we're spending a lot of money and making a change and moving that money from one place to another would be a very difficult thing, but something we should definitely be looking at. So appreciate all the discussion. I'm gonna call on Representative Quam. Unless Representative Grunhagen, did you have anything further before I go to him?
Yeah, just real quickly. Madam Chair, I understand the need to have some discussion on this, that's for sure. I mean, we're talking about $16 billion. I mean, we can't just ignore it. And I do appreciate that you in the past, as well as I, have brought up questions about this. A quick question is, you know, on the county-based purchasing, I just, you know, I have looked into that with county commissioners and medical people locally, at least in my area, they seem very satisfied with it. But I'm not saying we can't talk about that. Second thing is, do you have a fiscal note on your either of your bills? I was going to ask that last time, and I just wondering.
Not yet, Representative Grunhagen, but I am anxiously awaiting those fiscal notes. So thank you. Representative Quam, and then we need to finish this up. We have one more bill. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of quick things. One, it was much more simple around a decade or more ago before there was a major change on the federal level that added complexity and cost. But on the point of this bill, my understanding was that there was a rebate if there was cost savings that was given back to the state. And I know that we'd have to pay the feds for it because when it came to light, the state was taken to court or some administrative thing because they didn't feed back some of that money that was returned to them from managed care organizations. So it'd be maybe nice to have some of that history distributed to the members of the committee so they see that some of that money, if it's saved, comes straight back to the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks, Representative Crum. I know what you're talking about, but anyway, there's a lot of history to this, 27 years worth. So anyway, we'll have more conversation about this, I hope. And with that, members, I'm going to lay over House File 3823 for possible inclusion in the health bill. So we will move on now to Representative Bolden. And this is, let's see, this is House File 3860. And we are hearing this bill informationally. And we're just confining ourselves to the part that is within this committee. And we do have a couple of testifiers. So Representative Bolden, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So I am grateful to be able to present this bill to you this afternoon. The bill aims to recruit and support licensed school nurses, or LSNs. And as we know, those nurses support students. Licensed school nurses have always been an incredibly important part of our schools, and we've certainly seen that over the last 2 years of the pandemic. LSNs support students with their physical and mental health needs, both acute and chronic. They provide and coordinate care and are a bridge from healthcare to education. The workforce challenges we're seeing across many sectors are also a reality in our school health offices. This bill would create a grow your own opportunities for school nurses. The section specific to this committee today would add licensed school nurses to the loan forgiveness program with the goal of supporting school health aides in their education and training should they choose to move forward in an LSN career. So we do have a couple of testifiers, and so with your permission, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to them. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much, Representative Bolden. So, Jolie Holland, welcome to the committee.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name's Jolie Holland. I'm a second-generation licensed school nurse, and I'm the legislative chair for the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota, or SNOM. And we thank Representative Bolden for authoring House File 3860 to recruit, train, and provide loan forgiveness for individuals who would like to become licensed school nurses or LSNs. SNOM believes that all students should have access to an LSN in their school. The lack of licensed school nurses is an everywhere problem in rural, suburban, and urban Minnesota, and our students desperately need more LSNs. Minnesota law currently requires a licensed school nurse if there are 1,000 students or more. A district with 999 students isn't required to hire an LSN, and a school district with, say, 6,000 students is only required to hire one LSN. I work in a rural community covering 16 schools and programs in 11 locations. Did you know that only one-third of Minnesota schools have a licensed school nurse, and that the nurse-to-student ratio is currently one LSN to 1,403 students? SNOM thinks that Minnesota can do better. Since 1986, medical technology has greatly improved, and the increase in the number of medical issues which require health and emergency plans for students is staggering. Children are coming to school with severe allergies, diabetes, asthma, seizures, mental health issues, along with G-tubes, tracheostomies, and so much more. Parents write notes to the school nurse and about their child's mental and their medical problem, not realizing that the health office person reading that note may have little or no training. Many schools in Minnesota have health assistants or secretaries that are doing the work of licensed school nurses. Chair Liebling, we sincerely thank you for this hearing. This is the first time that we can recall that a school nurse issue has been discussed in the health committee, and we think it's very appropriate, and we commend you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holland. And we also have Liz, is it Zeno?
Zeno, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Liz Zeno. I'm a licensed school nurse and a member of the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. I've worked for Minneapolis Public Schools for the last 29 years. I'm excited about this bill. Minneapolis Public Schools is a diverse urban school district. Our health offices are staffed by teams of licensed school nurses and paraprofessional health assistants, or LPNs. We've worked hard to hire staff to better reflect the diversity of our students. We have done fairly well with the paraprofessional positions. More than half of our health assistants and LPNs are people of color, but we have struggled to find diversity among our licensed school nurse candidates, and our current nurses are almost all white and female. I recently had a long conversation with one of our outstanding health assistants. She's frustrated at the lack of opportunity for advancement. She would love to become a licensed school nurse, but she has a young family, and the cost of furthering her education is a major barrier. The option to seek loan forgiveness for working in schools and other provisions of this bill will create opportunities for our health staff to advance as professionals and bring more nurses of color into our schools. Having more professional nurses of color in our schools will be especially important in addressing the mental health issues. The last 2 years have had serious consequences for the mental health of all our students. School nurses have an important role in supporting students' mental health. Many students' mental health issues are brought to the health office in the forms of stomach aches, headaches, and more. Nurses teach self-care for minds and bodies. The pandemic has taught us a lot about inequities in healthcare and the consequences of a lack of trust in the healthcare system on communities of color. Having more professional nurses of color in our schools can help bridge that trust gap and enhance the physical and mental health of all our students. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Zeno. Really appreciate you being here today. Any questions or comments from members? All right, final word, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a final thank you to our testifiers, and thanks for hearing the bill. It's an important topic and hope it moves forward. Thank you.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for bringing it. Representative Bolden, thank you very much to the two testifiers. We appreciate your being here today and hope to have more on school nursing. It is very, very important. So thank you. All right, members, with that, we have reached the end of our agenda. We will see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock. And with that, we stand adjourned.